This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Are we ready to start? It doesn't seem very interactive or informal, really. Would people want to come to the front? We've been asked to speak for 10 minutes, so there will be lots of time for discussion. So I hope that will work well. I'm Marion Brandon, and this is my colleague Ruth Gardner. And we've both been involved in analysis of serious case reviews nationally. We've done the last three reviews for England. So what we're going to be talking about is the review that was published last year into cases from 2005 to 2007. I have to say that we've done a review of cases from 2007 to 9, and that report is available in draft. We're not allowed to talk about that for the moment. But I will give you an idea of some of the themes. So we're talking about understanding serious case reviews and their impact. And I guess it was very nice to be name-checked this morning by Paul Ennals, but I have to say that I really am not the national or global expert on how to do serious case reviews at all, because what we do is look at it from the outside from a research perspective. And my interest in looking at serious case reviews, and I've been doing it for over a decade now, is not so much about the situation after a child's been injured or died, but what can we learn about everyday practice? I'm really passionately interested in how we can make ordinary everyday practice better rather than being so concerned about what happens after the event. So I guess what we're going to be talking about in the next 10 minutes, and I'll start and Ruth will finish, is sort of thinking about understanding serious case reviews and their impact from two different angles. Firstly, how can we understand what's going on? How can we understand what's going on in the families, what's going on in the interaction between the agencies and the workers? And then the second bit is what can we understand about the serious case review process itself? So I'm going to talk about the first bit about understanding the families and the interactions with workers, and then Ruth's going to talk a little bit about the process from some interviews and discoveries we did there. Oh, now it's stuck. Right. Because we've been looking at serious case reviews, three lots of cases, we've looked at, by the time we published the report last year, we looked at 350 cases. And if we include the ones we've looked at now, it's over 600. So I guess one of the interesting questions is, are serious case reviews unique? Is each one different, or are they part of a pattern? And I think the answer is both. They are each individually unique. They are so different that you can't compare them across. Also, there are some patterns and some themes and some recurring trends which I think are helpful. So if we looked at both of them, the studies that we've looked at and the new one, then these themes come through. So one of the interesting and important themes, I think, and I don't think this was known before we started doing these analyses, was that not all of these families by any means are known to children's social care. So at the time a child is harmed or killed, we know that just under half of these children aren't known to children's social care at the time of the incident. However, we do know that three quarters of them were known in the past. So this brings to mind issues about thresholds and are families being battered in and out of services. But at the time, it's not just social workers' issues, it's everybody. So it's safeguarding children really is everyone's responsibility if we're going to learn from serious case reviews. Furthermore, we also know that most children who die or are killed or are seriously injured aren't deep into the child protection system. Less than one in five children have a current child protection plan at the time of the incident. So cases like the Baby Peter case are unusual. There, one in five of serious case reviews are where a child is featured having a child protection plan. Now, we could say that that shows that the child protection system is on the whole working well because, you know, most children aren't being harmed in that way. Or we could say that one in five on serious case reviews, that's unacceptable. So it depends how you want to read that, really. So, but before we become too complacent, it's not as if there weren't known risks in the past, because we know that in one in three cases, either that child at an earlier stage or a sibling had a plan in the past. So again, we've got the importance of history. If we want to learn about the age of the child, we know from all of these cases and the one at the moment that the age profile is almost identical each time we look at them. So almost half of all serious case reviews are concerning children aged under one, and most of those are under 3 months. They're very young babies. Nearly a quarter are aged 1 to 5. Nearly a quarter are older children, aged 11 to 17, and there are quite a few children aged over 16. But less than 10% are children aged 6 to 10. So cases like Victoria Climbier, Kyra Ishak, those very high-profile, very distressing cases are very unusual. It's mostly babies or under fives and a small subgroup of teenagers. What we're discovering over time is that more cases are being selected for serious case review that are serious injuries. Still more cases of child death are reviewed, but serious injuries are creeping up in volume. So that's a part of a pattern, and we know from looking at trends that this is coming through time and time again. So there are important pieces of learning here for all the workforce needs to be involved. Because there are so many babies, health visitors, the role of universal health visiting services and other services are really important. And children are maybe safeguarded because they're in school. So these universal services like health and education are crucial to safeguarding children. One of the other things we were concerned about when we did these studies is to have a theory that drives what we're looking for and how we understand. So when we're analysing and examining these cases, we use something, a bit of a mouthful, an ecological transactional approach. So we're thinking about the children in their environment, we're thinking about the interaction of all of the players involved in the child's story. And we use that to understand, and we think it's a really helpful way to make sense of day-to-day practice. And my colleague David Howe from the University of East Anglia has been very influential in guiding us in this way. And if we're going to look at things in this way, we need to think about the carer's own relationships and their history. We've got to be interested in the past as well. And we need to think about their state of mind and their level of reflective function. Are they able to keep their child in mind? Are they able to think about beyond their immediate preoccupation? And what kind of caregiving environment is generated by that carer? And how is the child's behaviour having an effect on that? So if we've got the example of a new premature baby who has makes enormous demands on their caregiver, if we put the combination of a premature, needy baby with a volatile, highly stressed young man with a history of domestic violence, those things need to be kind of borne in mind. So all of these factors are affected by social stresses, by relationships, and by environmental stresses. And the professional relationship is part of that meshing too. So we've looked at the cases we look at in depth, we look at through that lens, really. And then the last slide that I'm going to be talking about is when we kind of think in this way, we have a robust methodology that's probably a bit boring to go into detail now, but we look minimal detail about every single case, so we don't pick out one or some. We look at all of them to gather our overall information. Then we try and look at a small number in depth. And when we look at a smaller number of cases in depth, usually 40 or 50, you get a much richer understanding of what's going on. It's not just statistics. You start to get underneath and discover. And when we looked at the cases, the 40 cases last year, and we sat together as researchers in a group, then this kind of pattern came through our families. Chaotic isn't really a good word. It presumes all sorts of things. But the level of chaos that was around, not just in the families, but also in the professional responses, struck us as quite significant. And we were able to kind of have a pattern, a repeating cycle that affected a lot of families and a lot of practice. So if we start with the overwhelmed, chaotic families on the right, these families tended to have not just poor support from their family, but negative support from their families. So the child's mother might be... her drug dealer might be her mum, or her mum might be picking fights with her, physical fights, that sort of thing. Lots of substance misuse, domestic violence, mental ill health and criminality in families. In families like that, we found that there's too much to achieve, that families have low expectations of themselves, but also professionals tend to have low expectations of those families. So success tends to be getting through the door. And often in these cases, there was quite a muddle about confidentiality, who should know what and who shouldn't, and the professionals were in a muddle. So the muddle in the family gets into the muddle in the professional's head. because these families are largely suffering social exclusion, they've had a hard time, they've had often very difficult, troubled histories themselves, when professionals were working with them from substance misuse services or from domestic violence programs, they were very concerned not to be judgmental, very concerned to try and see the best in this person. But there was a confusion between not being judgmental and not making judgments. So instead of making judgments that they were often required to do about the safety of the child, they were saying, well, let's think of the best of this mum. So young pregnant mum went for drug testing and went lots of time, was trying really hard, but every time the tests were positive. But the drug substance misuse service was saying, well, she's really trying hard. She was trying hard, but she wasn't actually succeeding, and the child was at risk. So the whole picture can be missed, and separate agencies worked in silos and didn't work together for the safety of the whole child. Often there tended to be fairly fixed views about the family. Once a group of professionals had decided what kind of a family it was, so if it was a neglect family, in inverted commas, then they didn't think about the risks of physical harm to the child. And if it was a family where there used to be domestic violence, but it was now better, that again wasn't reconsidered. So very important to have an open mind about what's going on. Sometimes men were thought of as all good or all bad, not people who could change and sometimes be one thing and sometimes be another. So when this, all of these things go round and round and round, you can see how somehow the children are just lost. The children are invisible because there's so much going on in the interaction between the parents and the workers, between the parents individually and between the individual problems that somehow that just gets lost in the middle. And we found that sometimes was true of the serious case reviews as well. So I'm now going to turn to Ruth, who's going to talk a little bit more about the process of serious case reviews.
Hello, everyone. With these lights, I can't really even see you, so it feels very uninteractive, I have to say, very impersonal. So I do hope we start talking soon. Just briefly to say, I really read the report again that Marion largely wrote for 0507, Understanding Serious Case Reviews and Their Impact, and I do recommend it to you. It doesn't, you know, just give the bad stories. It gives lots and lots of good practice tips from people working on serious case reviews. And there's lots of really clear ideas about what best practice looks like. So if it's no longer on the DfE website, I expect you can get it from the university. But yes, so there'll be a link on the website at the university, if nowhere else. But it still makes very contemporary, very good reading, and the evidence base for it now is a very large sample, so it's very sound. Although we do make it very clear that these cases are not typical of safeguarding practice, they are the outliers in a sense in terms of what's happened. But this part of the study was about how practitioners had become involved and the effects on them, and we actually did telephone interviews about 17 serious case reviews with senior managers and or practitioners who had been directly involved, which was extremely interesting and hadn't been done before in one of these biennial reviews. And as you might expect, the impact, even if it had happened several years before, had been both profound and long-lasting. People felt they had been emotionally scarred. They felt that at least initially they had completely lost confidence. And I suppose this does raise questions about publication and about whether people will actually volunteer themselves and what will happen if they don't, if they feel that this is about exposure rather than transparency. They really did believe, ultimately, and that's why they went through it, that the purpose was to learn. And I think that is an absolutely key priority with serious case reviews, whatever form they take in future. However, some people felt that having been through this mill, they had come out more assertive in their practice and in their expression of their own judgments and their views, that in the end they felt that as a professional they would always in future say, no, I don't agree with that decision, that whoever was in charge, they would feel the focus of their work was the child, and that they would feel freer, really, in dissenting if they felt that was best practice. And I think that's really interesting, because certainly when you talk about neglect to managers and practitioners, as I have been doing, having practiced in that area myself in the past, people say, now I've got more experience, I sometimes revisit the very cases I worked on, and I would be more confident. I would have said, no, we've had enough now, and I would have pushed it with a senior manager. And that's what I now advise people to do. So that's interesting in itself. However, practitioners did feel excluded from the serious case review process by and large, and some managers we spoke to, because of cuts, because of other pressures, because a number of serious case reviews happened at the one time, they were saying, well, actually, the dissemination process didn't happen, no. We weren't able to sit down with individuals and talk them through, and people who'd been involved felt they'd really been dumped by the process. We have got examples that counter that. For instance, one person said there were some real issues around staff morale. I did a management review where instead of going out and interviewing people separately and leaving them anxious, I did a round robin and asked all those involved in the case to write up their evaluation of what had happened and then set everybody around a table to talk it through. It was the least damaging way, and it was a model that worked better for us. So, as I say, the report's full of those ideas, and I expect some people here may have been involved in the Sky model. Have they, by the way? Is anyone out there who's experienced that model? Can't see any hands. But I'm sure that Eileen Munro will be looking at that, because she was involved in that work of that more collective approach, although I don't think it's been applied to serious cases yet. Oh, gosh, I've turned it off. Think.
No,
I haven't. No, all is well. Come back. So from all this information, we distilled, if you like, these cycles, which again, to people who've been through the serious case review process, in a sense, they simply sum up what's known already. On the left-hand side, you have the worst case, really, that the child really isn't at the centre of the serious case review, and I'm afraid we read far too many where the child had not been known, I'm afraid, for long periods of the work. The child's experience simply hadn't been understood. And unfortunately, still even in the serious case review, the child didn't come through at all. I mean, there were a few cases where children hadn't been known to any children who'd been through the care process or whatever and should have been known, were in fact known to no one, including their families, at the time of their death or serious injury. But at the same time, too many serious case reviews really didn't show the child's existence at all. It was more about what organisations had been up to. So really that arose, seemed to be part of a kind of defensive practice where serious case reviews, you know, had become a target, had to be got through, and there was a fear about the whole process, really, including what families might do, and families and practitioners, by and large, felt excluded from the process. And that did tend to be more characteristic, if you like, of some places than of others. So it's as though practice can get into that cycle. Whereas in many cases, fortunately, it was quite different. You could see the child's experience. You could understand the siblings, the whole family structure around it. Clearly, someone had looked at that data and brought it to life. There was an attempt, even if it wasn't successful, there had been attempts to involve the family, and sometimes some very crucial information had been obtained that way. There had been a willingness to find ways of sharing knowledge in the executive summary, even though that was very difficult, and a sense that the media had to have a strategy so that there was involvement with the media ongoing, so that when a serious case review came up, then the lessons could be shared, and understanding about how to cope with some of the stresses of that, if you like, for staff, and more creative methods of learning like the ones I've mentioned, in terms of running groups, really, for people as well to discuss what had happened. And a much more openness, really, about the learning and understanding about the agency context, what had been going on in the agencies at the time. Some of that's the most powerful learning, and very often that wasn't there in some other cases where people had felt that was too sensitive to discuss. So I think that's our contribution. We're very happy to share, anything else from the report and any more ideas and answer questions.